My name is Mike, and this is The Goods. On this show, we go inside the minds of designers of all kinds and discover their methods, mindset, and how you can use their insights to bring your ideas to life. In this episode, you'll meet Adam Harrigan, a senior industrial designer at Koala, a young Australian company making beautiful furniture that's strong, simple to assemble, and made to last. In our conversation, we explore why getting your hands dirty is so important, how good mentors can shape your design process, why insights are crucial to Koala, and much, much more. So without any more delay, please enjoy episode 3 of The Goods with Adam Harrigan. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Oh, it's really great to have you on, man. I really wanted to kick off with the first question around your background and when you realized you wanted to be a designer.
When did I realize I wanted to be a designer? Pretty early on, I think. I've always realized that sort of the more academic areas, sort of like maths and English and all those sorts of things through school, were definitely not my strong points. I much preferred being creative, being hands-on, working in that sort of area. So I think, you know, definitely had a lot of inspiration from my grandfather sort of growing up. He was an engineer, and when he came across to Australia from Estonia, you know, worked for a company that was called Email at the time, and then it eventually changed into Westinghouse. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, so that sort of, he was a head engineer for those guys, and, you know, sort of worked his way through that for, God, the majority of the life that I knew him through, at least the 30 years that he was alive while I was alive, or when I was born from to now. So getting to see someone who was very hands-on and, you know, have so many fond memories of spending time with him in his workshop, tinkering with things. You know, he sort of had a hobby of faceting crystals and looking for sort of different types of stones and things like that, and bringing them back, and we'd, you know, carve them into different things. So, yeah, I sort of spent a lot of time, you know, in the workshop with him, learning how to be hands-on and to create something and to sort of work in a way where you know, sort of working with something that doesn't, coming up with an idea from somewhere that, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be formulated. It was just a, you know, an organic sort of artistic sort of element to it. So as a kid, you know, you really enjoy that. So when I went through to high school, you know, definitely moved across more into enjoyment with things like woodworking and design and technology and things like that. So when you get to that point in your final years of high school and they're trying, and you're sort of trying to work out what's next, it's, yeah, sort of led across into design. But yeah, where I went to school, you know, the term industrial designer wasn't really something that was thrown around a lot. So it took a little bit of research to understand what did that area of study mean. But as soon as I started reading through it, I knew that's exactly what I needed to do or what I wanted to do. And then going, I just remember my first sort of couple of weeks at university at Newcastle and meeting the head of design there, or the head lecturer, Graham Paver, and, you know, so much background, worked on one of the first laptops to be ever made, wow. Had a heap of other projects through furniture and electronics and things. And so just hugely inspired by him. So I think, yeah, probably about 2 weeks into that, I knew that design is what I wanted to do.
And was your work in that workshop with your grandfather something that you think truly gave you that access to explore design? Because I imagine, like, you're working with him in the workshop, you're constructing things, and he's probably, like, teaching you skills and, like, how to use your hands and how to actually, like, build things together.
Yeah, I think he helped me realize that, or understand and learn that things that exist in your life, they're made by somebody.
Yeah, wow.
That sort of way. So when you're sitting on a chair or looking at a table or looking at a cabinet or an appliance, you know, I think a lot of people would look at it and go, it just comes from a shop. You know, I go down the road and,
the shop
and
makes
buy this
it.
And it just, the shop makes it, yeah. And having an understanding that people make these things and come up with these ideas and innovate along the way, you know, that was pretty cool to understand. And, you know, I think the coolest thing that I could have ever seen with my grandfather was he built a fridge the whole way along the line that he wanted to take home. So he had this super funky kind of curved front retro Westinghouse fridge that, you know, lasted the whole way through. It's actually, from what I understand, because I wanted to try and keep it, but I think the amount of power that that thing would have chewed would just not have been ideal.
Up to scratch, yeah.
Yeah. But we ended up sort of donating it to a sort of a, what would you call them, like a retro furniture appliance guy, and he ended up taking that on, and he was just surprised at how the fact that even though it was, I think it's over 45 years old, it was still functioning completely. Wow. to the way it should have been when it was first made. So yeah,
it's a testament to your grandfather's craftsmanship and the build quality that he was like striving for.
It just blew my mind that, you know, he followed that thing along the line in terms of all the elements that were molded and pressed and assembled, you know, to be able to sort of experience that, you know, sort of that story of him telling me that. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I think it's also a really uncommon thing now for one person to see something at the start through to completion. Like a lot of the factories that I read about have multiple people doing a small element and assembling this thing along the way. So I think this is like a really rare approach to have, even maybe in your grandfather's day.
Yeah, I think he was pretty privileged to be able to do it. So I think, you know, sort of being in the position that he was, he could kind of follow along the line and work with those people. But yeah, it's definitely in Australia not something that you get to experience that often. But it was, you know, having that understanding or having that element of inspiration that went behind it is one of the reasons why I wanted to become a designer. But I definitely had more of a passion for furniture than I did for appliances.
Yeah, got it. How did you discover that passion for furniture?
I just like making things. I think, you know, high school, getting to sort of spend time in the workshop and work with woodwork especially and build cabinets and things like that, you know, that was just something I always really enjoyed doing. I think every young teenage boy likes making something out of a woodwork shop, but I just wanted to sort of continue on with that and do something a little bit further. So, yeah, I've just always had a love to do things with wood, essentially. Other materials as well now, but, yeah, wood's always been something that's been really close to me because I just enjoy, I don't know, I suppose I'm a type of person that's always on the go, so I find that working with that sort of material, it can slow you down at times and relax you. Yeah, not so much from when you're working for a larger company and doing, you know, sort of design and development. This is more the hobby side, but
got it.
That's what got me into it initially. Yeah.
And what was the first thing that you ever designed and made yourself?
Designed and made myself. If you exclude high school works, sort of going into university, there was just bits and pieces in between that, sort of having a tinker in the workshop. So if I exclude high school work and assignments and things like that, it would have been a weird little TV cabinet, actually.
Okay.
Mum and Dad have actually still got it. But it's yeah, it was this thing that sort of sat in the corner. It's I look back at it and think, thank goodness I've progressed as a designer since then. But they seem to love it. So yeah.
It's quite interesting. My parents also have a whole bunch of my artwork at home and it's stuff that I designed and drew when I was in high school. And I always go back home and I'm like, wow, I've really like come a long way since I was doing that kind of stuff. So I totally get that, where it's like almost a piece of your past that they just hold on to, that whenever you see them, you're like, okay, that's that old thing. Like there it is.
Yeah.
Always there.
Right, and I'm glad it holds all of those, you know, really important elements like CDs and VHS and all the stuff that that you never touch anymore. I might be showing my age there by saying VHS, but yeah, it was important at the time.
For sure. You mentioned that you've studied at university, and I wanted to like dig into that a little bit and understand like how you actually progressed through university to then get your start in furniture design.
Yep. Well, I progressed through like anyone who studies industrial design, you do your time there. So it was a four year course that I had to do. And I think in terms of the transition from study to work, I did that partway through my third year, where I was studying. There was an extremely long break at the end of the year. I think it ended up equating to almost 4 months. So I sort of thought, you know, why not try to get some experience in the industry. So yeah, between third and fourth year, I just started looking, I think it might've, just Googling sort of where Australian manufacturers were in the furniture industry. So I started just looking through the list that was there and I shortlisted it down to about three or four places and just picked up the phone and started calling through and saying, hey, my name's Adam. I'm an industrial designer. Have a love for furniture. Looking for some experience. Would you be willing to have me come down? And, yeah, I think the second place that I called, which was probably the first on my list because I had some really pretty pictures and really cool designs that were there, and I thought, oh, this would be the right one to go to. Yeah, they said come down and have a chat, and I went down and met the owner, Dennis, and, yeah, that day he said, yeah, sure, come back next week, and it kind of went from there. I pretty much worked my entire 4 months as much as I could through that spot, and I met probably my biggest inspiration as a designer, Sonny, who was the research and development manager there. I think because he reminded me a lot of my grandfather, and he was this guy who just had an incredible ability to tinker with things and make things work, and I'd never seen anything like that. And being able to sort of see someone who, although I'd done things in the past that were very hands-on, to be able to see someone in that sort of industry work at the level that he did was just, it just blew my mind, because a lot of the things that you do in university, you know, they're very, almost feel a little bit fictitious. You know, you're sort of saying, oh, it'd be nice if I could make this, or this part's going to be injection molded or cast or extruded to do this certain thing, and it always just stays as a pretty sketch or a rendering, whereas, you know, here actually things were happening. So
fantastic.
Yeah, so they had a really big project that had come up during that time, so that's, I think, that why they were able to kind of get me on and use me as a bit of labor. So I just basically shadowed Sonny for the first few months that I was there, and ended up sort of working part-time through my final year of university, and then that's where I went to work after, because I just fell in love with the place. It was a family-owned business, still going, 54 years in operation now in manufacturing. Wow. So, yeah, it was just it gave me my start, so I'm forever grateful for that. But, yeah, learnt so much working there as well, which was cool.
What were some of the key lessons that you learned by shadowing Sonny?
Get your hands dirty.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
What does that look like, actually, like making the stuff yourself, or?
Yeah, sort of. I think, like a lot of designers, I love to sketch. So I love to get on a sketchbook and start to come up with ideas and think about it in that way, where Sonny was very practical, and he taught me to, yes, it's great to draw those things out, but you, at the same time, go and build the bloody thing and have a look at it, and then you'll solve a lot more problems in a faster way by being able to do that. So, yeah, I was quite lucky with that type of role, because the, you know, this manufacturing facility was like a massive workshop, so you could go through and work in timber, steel, plastic, aluminium, upholstery, all different sorts of things. So it was pretty cool in that way. But that would be the biggest lesson that I learned from him, which was, you know, just go and get your hands dirty, go and build it, build a little mock-up of it, build a prototype, test that little feature or connection detail or problem that you're trying to solve, and that will speed things along. So yeah, he sort of taught me to not be afraid of equipment. And get ideas across that way. So, yeah.
Fantastic. And what were some of the ways that you did build and test things? Would it just be something you would test yourself, or did you have some, you know, people that would come in that would help you test out the different things that you were building? What did that look like?
It depends on what you were working on, but, you know, it's very hard with certain things that you're designing that need to be geared for manufacture. You sometimes can't use those manufacturing sometimes can't use that manufacturing equipment or the tooling or something like that straight away. You've got to find a way to be a little bit ad hoc and mock up that part first. So you might machine something out of a solid piece of aluminium, or just glue random bits and pieces together. So there was that element, which was the really early stages of a design. But then there was also if I needed something done at a higher level of quality, more detail and accuracy, I was able to go and work with a specialist in a particular area. So whether it was someone who was incredible at wood, at joinery, or someone who was really good at welding or fabricating, you know, I could sort of go and spend time along with that person, which was a pretty fast way to grow up, because you sort of learnt the importance of communicating with people that were much older than you and much more experienced than you. So you never wanted to come across as being arrogant by saying, hey, I've got an idea, can you make it? Because if you sort of, you go over there and to one of the guys and say, hey, this is what I need you to make, you know, they're not going to give you the time of day. So you have to I learned pretty early on, and I think I would have only been maybe 22 when I went over there, that sort of, you know, as a young young guy, you've got to sort of earn respect.
Yeah.
Especially in Australian manufacturing.
Yeah. And how would you actually approach working with the more senior designers or people that were making things there? Was there a particular process or practice that you would have to do? Like, would you?
I just honestly wanted to learn from them. You know, you just, and if you can show them that respect and they can see that, that's the best way to get across, because then you don't come across as saying that you're the authority figure or you're someone who knows better than they do. You know, you just go in there with a completely open mind and show that to them, that you want to learn from them, and they'll show you everything, everything that they know. I think it's a pretty rare person, and in that particular organization, because it was very tight-knit, family-owned, there was a lot of really nice people who had been there for long periods of time and were more than happy to part with their knowledge, provided that you showed them the respect that they deserved.
Mm. And in the early parts of the process, before you would actually go to these more senior people, is there something that you would do, like what would you focus on first before actually taking an idea to them? Is there like, would you have a prototype or an idea or something there?
Yeah. Try to give them some detail. You know, I think anyone who works in that type of industry is usually a visual person. So,
got it.
You know, get some good visuals or a good prototype prior to going to see them. So you can say, hey, this is the problem I'm trying to solve. Here's some images or drawing something with them. Because if you just try to communicate that with them verbally and say, oh, I've got this long kind of thing which needs to bend this way and connect to this, they're going to look at you as confused as you are trying to explain it. So, yeah, just working on visual communication, which is probably the most important tool for a designer.
Yeah, yeah. I think in general, like designers have to be great at communicating, particularly like the problems that they're trying to solve, or at least the problem that they're experiencing with their current prototype, so that other people can at least help unblock you and provide an access to provide a solution perhaps.
Definitely. Yeah.
And from your time working in that factory, is there a favorite failure or maybe like a key lesson that you've learned that's maybe set you up for later success?
Yeah, I mean, probably the biggest failure that I worked on would have been trying to work with motors for height adjustability. We had almost a 2-year project that we were working on, which just ended up failing because we went in the wrong direction. We weren't willing to pivot from that. So, you know, sort of seeing the outcome of that, I learned so much from that failure because I learned from what we did wrong with that, and not, there was nothing negative along the process. Do you know what I mean? We would get something through, we'd test it, we'd iterate it, we'd say, okay, this seems to be pretty good, but we didn't do enough research prior to understand what the market was doing. I think to really get that product across the line. So in terms of other things that were failures, there's little bits and little stories here and there in terms of just, but they're sort of more just usually coming down to not giving someone enough information and giving that correct information and those details prior to something going onto the factory floor. Because there was two elements that we're working on. One was the ideation R&D sort of element where you could make things and expect to fail. There was that component of, you know, when this thing actually did need to transition across from a prototype into a manufacturable item, then, and you needed to communicate that to X number of people in different sections of the factory. I learned pretty hard and fast to sort of, you know, what was required there, because there was a lot of times where you'd get 2/3 of a way through a project and realize that someone hadn't interpreted something correctly, and it was entirely your fault because you hadn't put the correct documentation together or you'd missed a dimension and things like that. So there was plenty of times where you'd get partway through a project and someone would sort of, I wouldn't say plenty of times, because once you make that mistake once, you don't make it again. But just communication and documentation was pretty important, because it's a horrible feeling when you go out to look at a product or one of the first items that comes off that factory line and you realize that it's not what it was supposed to be, and you know, and that it is your fault. It's a pretty horrible feeling. So at the time it feels awful, but then when you look at it in retrospect, you realize you learn a lot from it.
Yeah. Is there any like process when that does occur that you go back and try and identify where the breakdown actually occurred? Like, is there a process that you deploy around that kind of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, when I was younger, you know, you sort of, maybe I was a little bit arrogant, but you think that everything you do is correct. So it was, you know, you just, there was a little bit of time there where I'd be like, I couldn't have possibly made a mistake. So at first, you know, there was that element which I had to sort of overcome and learn from. But then once I did get through that, in terms of ensuring that it doesn't happen again, it was just double checking, triple checking the work that you're doing at those latter stages of a project. I'm not sure if that answered the question correctly, but that was, that's the way that I sort of remember it.
Yeah, I think what that reminds me of is learning from my dad, who is, he was a carpenter and became a firefighter. So he's got this incredible breadth of knowledge that he's built up, because in the area that he studied or he practiced carpentry, you had to learn plumbing and electrical and the carpentry. And this saying that he told me when I was very young has always stuck with me, and that's measure twice, cut once.
Yeah.
And I try and apply that to my design practice now, my work now. And I just think, like, you know, be prepared, understand it, measure it, and then only just cut that one time. Be as prepared as you possibly can so that you can deliver the right thing the first time.
I think I've had 3 or 4 teachers / mentors that have said very similar things to me. So, yeah, that often comes to mind, and it's just an unconscious practice now, especially when you're making something, to sort of check that measurement twice before you cut it.
Yeah. What do you think, this might be an unusual question, but did you have any bad habits as a young designer that you've kind of ironed out of your process? Because I know myself, like what you were saying before, I believed I was right and I couldn't possibly be wrong in the early parts of my design career. And, you know, there are certainly some moments that have humbled me and just opened me to the possibility that perhaps I don't know enough as what I think I do, and that I could probably use a bit of schooling there.
I think going back to that get your hands dirty comment that I was telling you, the sort of saying to you with Sunny, it's a very similar thing comes to mind if I'm thinking about bad habits, was I would often hide inside a sketchbook to try and get an idea across. So sort of learning that, because from a university or a study perspective, you did have a lot of time to spend on a project. You didn't realize that at the time because you thought everything was, you know, this is a huge project and how am I ever going to get everything done? But when you go out into the real world of design, you realize that those things have to happen quite quickly. And I think at the beginning I was quite slow and would want to perfect a pretty picture and that word perfect or perfection definitely comes to mind. And I think that was a big thing which I had to overcome. And it wasn't until I spoke again, sort of after working professionally, back to my lecturer Graham, where he was sort of referring to it as, you know, it's not, you don't have to do things perfectly. It's not about perfection. You can do things exceptionally, but you don't have to do things perfectly. And trying to keep that in mind when I'm working on things now, it definitely speeds me up, because I don't spend too much time on making something like a sketch perfect or a rendering perfect, because that's only part of the process. So trying to overcome that, I've found has definitely sped me up, because I definitely at times, you know, would scrunch up a piece of paper because I wasn't happy with a line that I'd drawn, but it had no relevance whatsoever to the overall, you know, sort of success of the project or
not. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. You can't really sit on a sketch, right?
No, it's one of many things that you need to do in the process. So, yeah, I've definitely become a bit more efficient with that over the years, I think.
Yeah, I loved a little note that you mentioned before around like the difference between perfection and like being exceptional.
Yes.
How do you relate to the distinction between the two? Because I see a lot of younger designers focusing on getting things perfect really early in the, say, a mock-up in, you know, design tool or something like that. But really the thing that people interact with is in my work as a UX designer is the actual thing that you build. So is there something like that for a furniture designer or an industrial designer?
I think I didn't properly learn this until working at Koala. I think the idea of an MVP, what is your minimum viable product? You know, looking at it in that way removes perfection or perfectionism very quickly, because you look at it in a way and going, what's the, not necessarily the least amount of work, but what's the minimum viable amount of work that I need to do and the minimum amount of features that I need to put into this product to get it out to the market and get it tested so I can iterate or I can do another version of this. That's probably the most important thing that I've learned in terms of removing that perfection side of things, because you can do an MVP exceptionally by putting in good sort of research and groundwork before launching that product. But, you know, that's how I distinguish the two, I suppose. Like, you, to do exceptional is to understand what's enough, knowing that you can improve on it later.
Yeah, and focus on the improvement of that over time.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, great. You mentioned Koala, and I think this is a great segue into the company that you work for right now. Can you tell us a little bit about Koala and how you first came into contact with them?
Yeah, I got into contact with them when I was working at the manufacturer I was just mentioning. And it was actually a pretty strange phone call, because it came across from a fellow, and I can't remember his name, who was speaking to him. He just said, "Hey, I just want to see if you're interested in working for a mattress company." And the first thought that came to mind was, no, I'm very happy where I am. A mattress company does not really sound that interesting. I'm making furniture.
Yeah, a bit of a difference.
Thanks very much. And I said, I really think you should, look into the role and have a chat to the guys. They're young. They're really innovative and inspired by this new sort of startup / tech / physical product area of the market that seems to be emerging. So, sort of went and had a look through the role, and I've always had pretty open relationships or open conversations with my past and current employers. So I remember speaking to the owner of the company that I was at and just saying, "Hey, this is an opportunity that has come up. What do you think I should do?" And he said, "Go and have a chat to them. You've got nothing to lose. It's important that you get out and see the world work with other people." And so went and met Mitch, who is one of the owners of Koala, and he sat down with us and explained what his vision was and what he was looking at doing with growing the company and turning it from a mattress company into a furniture company. And I think just, sort of seeing it was quite a small office at the time, but just the energy that was in that office and seeing the guys work in there, it was very youthful. I felt quite, not that I was old when I started there, but I felt pretty old walking into that office. Seeing how it was all set up and the way the guys were working and the story behind what he was trying to do, it won me over on that day. I remember coming home to my wife, actually she was my fiance at the time, just incredibly excited about the opportunity, and said, "Man, look, this is the role that's there. What do you think?" And it felt like a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But there was something a little bit infectious about Mitch's energy at the time and what he wanted to do. So,
What was it about the story that really captured your attention, that had you see it like something you really wanted to do?
Disrupting the furniture industry. My God, there's a lot of crap in the market, and just that whole idea around disrupting that with quality furniture that is easy to assemble. And I know that sounds like I'm, trying to sell the product, but it really was that. It was just removing headache and complication. And, by that stage, I'd done my fair share of moving, my fair share of furniture assembly. And, I was pretty aware of the pain point that was in the industry. So to meet a company that was wanting to disrupt that was just perfect.
And what is it about Koala's focus on furniture design that is unique compared to what currently or what did exist in the market before them?
Putting things together without the use of a tool.
Yeah, got it.
That would probably be, there's plenty of other things that they do really, really well in terms of super fast delivery, amazing sort of marketing and online elements for that good customer experience. But from a design perspective, or the area that I was going into, it was, we need you to make this product. And the first product that we worked on or wanted to look at was the bed base, which needed to, that the problem was, we've got a mattress, it's doing really well, but we need to get this off the ground. We don't currently have a product, but we want to do something that's a little bit different. And it was the brief for that product was, we needed to get the mattress off the ground, and it needed to be done in a way that used zero tools and zero fixings. So, coming from manufacture where everything uses tools and everything uses fixings, it was a bit intimidating, but a hell of a brief to kick things off.
Yeah, and that's probably a great segue to talk about the bed base, because that is the first product that you designed at Koala, right?
It was, yeah. That was that was what I came across to do. So it's
given those constraints, like no tools, you know, easy to assemble. I've seen the site and I own one myself, and I think I was able to put it together in 4 minutes without any tools. So it's a remarkable piece of design, and aesthetically, it's beautiful as well. But how did you approach that design constraint? Like, where did you start to make that work? Because it sounds like what exists before is that you have screws and tools and like this really hard way to assemble things, and now you're trying to move into this easy future that no one else was looking at. So there was no reference point to start with, I imagine.
Yeah, there wasn't really much of a reference point. I mean, there were certain things, there were certain beds that were in the market that used a fixing without the use of a tool to go together, but the brief at the time was no fixings, no tools, so I needed to sort of think about how I could simplify it even further. We also had a pretty tight time to market. In most of the products that I've worked on in the past, you would allow 12 months to 2 years minimum to sort of get something designed, developed and put into market. You know, we had a much shorter time frame, and that was a big factor in the, I suppose, in the design and the development of it, which was I couldn't overcomplicate this. So, you know, I could have looked at ways of doing, you know, the really detailed sort of hard to manufacture elements that would have potentially resulted in something going together and meeting that brief, but it might have been really challenging to actually find a manufacturer to make that product. So yeah, when I started looking at it, I think there was probably 3 or 4 weeks that were in there where there was a lot of sketchbook time, just, you know, researching the market, looking at trends, looking at what was sort of what was inspiring me from materials and finishes, and getting that onto paper and just seeing what would happen. And it just, nothing was really coming together. Everything that I was drawing, I wasn't liking. It just didn't feel like it was going to be that was going to suit the brand. It didn't feel like it was going to sort of work logistically. It was going to be too heavy because we needed to sort of allow one person to be able to handle the components, but also handle a box to, you know, get it up a set of stairs. Or into an apartment that might have some tight, challenging areas to get through. So it was just, and then the strength element came into it as well, which is, you know, how do we, without putting too many legs on it, support this? And yeah, so there was, I think it must have been maybe into the third or the fourth week where it did feel a little bit, almost a little bit hopeless. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to be able to solve this problem. But I just went back to, you know, I just need the bed to be lifted. I just need to feel like it's floating. And I had this idea of wanting to float the bed in a way. That's all I needed. It didn't need to have a really solid, a really big base to it. It didn't need to have huge bed heads or anything, you know, super in your face. I really wanted it to just, I suppose, because of how successful the mattress was, I wanted it to be a plinth for that in a way, to sort of present the sort of the key product of the company at the time. So yeah, just went back to the drawing board by trying to really simplify it. And that idea of, I just need a floating platform. And just, and then with, you know, with Sonny, my old boss, in my head, get your hands dirty and start building some things. So I just started to, yeah, go out and play with some materials and play with the mattress, lift it off the ground, see what it looked like. And it started to come together pretty quickly after that. There was a handful of prototypes that we'd produced, but, you know, the very first successful prototype I'll always remember, because I was at the facility where I was producing it, and I just remember putting it together and putting the final piece in and sending a picture across to Mitch at Koala, and getting a phone call calling him straight away and saying, you have to get back to the office now.
Oh, really?
grab this bit of furniture, and we packed it up, put it into the back of my little wagon that I had, and took it downstairs, and I've still got the video on my phone in terms of just with the small group of people that we had in the company, we assembled it, and I think it took me about 3.5 minutes to put it together, and it just all slotted together beautifully, and chuck the mattress on the top, and that was sort of where it began.
Wow. And that was like the proof of concept, right?
Yeah, it was really just meant to be a prototype. Like, it was just first like 1.0 prototype. There was other ones which I'd sort of looked at, which, you know, weren't worth bringing in at the time, but this was the very first prototype that I was happy to put in front of someone, and it worked really well. The guys wanted to have it made straight away, like, let's get started. But that was the beginning of a lot of challenges.
Yeah, well, and actually getting that prototype together, was it just you working inside of a workshop? Did you have a team that was part of it? Like, how did that actually look to piece that together?
The prototyping bit was just me working inside a workshop, getting some things CNC cut, asking a few people, you know, a few people that I knew were, you know, sort of pretty savvy in that sort of area about, you know, what you know, size should I make these connection details? What are some of the challenges that I might face? What are some materials I should be looking for? And it went from there. Material was a huge one. You know, I wanted the product to be honest. So I was quite inspired by plywood at the time, and looking at a lot of the materials that are out there, have a huge love for solid timber, but knew there was going to be challenges in the weight and, you know, finding a manufacturer that would be able to work with joinery and, you know, sort of more complex details was potentially a challenge because I might have blown that timeline out a little bit. And then looking at other materials, you know, like MDF and chipboard and, you know, laminates and things like that, they were definitely out of the question because, again, I wanted the product to feel quite natural. Always been inspired by sort of natural timbers. So, yeah, that's sort of that. The idea of having plywood and maintaining the exposed edge of it was my way of keeping the product honest.
Yeah. Yeah, I've noticed like even with Koala, with the bed base, like the rounded corners, like you've got these design details that seem to carry throughout all of the different products that are now on the Koala site. And plywood features, it seems like it very heavily, like they're in that honest material, which is really quite lovely.
I think there's definitely things that we're working on in the future that won't be plywood, but it was a great product to start with because it allowed us to develop a Koala aesthetic. Using that material and then, you know, the idea of, you were sort of mentioning the curvature and things like that, I'm really liking things that don't have sharp edges. So, and I don't know if that's the father coming out in me, but I just like the look of things that don't necessarily have a, you know, a square edge. So it's a very traditional way to manufacture, to square edge things and put them together. And, you know, I look at a lot of our competitors and a lot of the other products that are out there, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to try and create something that was a little bit different, that didn't look like it had, although it will come off a factory line, there's no way of avoiding that. I didn't want it to look like that to a customer. I wanted to have it feel a little bit more hands-on and a bit more Australian. I don't know if that's not necessarily Australian, but just to feel honest.
You mentioned before as well, like this was the first product that had like the Koala aesthetic. And I wonder, like, it was there, when did you realize you had something that was an aesthetic that's unique to Koala? Like when did you have that aha moment? Was there anything that showed up throughout the design process?
The way we started getting some random people to put it together. We were doing, during this stage now, we had a couple of them made and we were testing them in the office, you know, sort of people were working on them. We had certain areas that we were concerned about in terms of like strength of the bed head and what the panels would be like if you were sitting on them for long periods of time, you know, would they bend, warp or crack? But it was starting to get a couple of different people to put it together. And one of the first assemblies that we did, we had a fellow that was across the road that was renovating an apartment, and he just needed a bed for a photo shoot. And we got him and his partner to put it together, and they were really stoked with the experience and looking at that. And I thought it was at that moment where I went, man, we could be onto something quite cool here. It's, you know, the way that they had responded into putting it together, there was always the fear that this was too simple, that what I had made was going to be, you know, not received professionally in the market. And then we're going to go, there's not enough complexity in this. It hasn't been designed with enough engineering, and where are the, you know, intricate German engineered connection details and things like that. But for the majority of our customers, they sort of looked at it as I think the way that I've referred to it in the past through some of the feedback was someone who generally labels themselves as bad at putting something together was able to do this. So they had a sense of achievement by doing it. And there was, you know, a couple of friends who sort of took a couple of prototypes early on and played with them. You know, they said a similar sort of thing, which was like, yeah, you know, my boyfriend John was always telling me that I'm crap at putting this together, but hey, look what I was able to do here. And that was a big part of the brief, where at the brief we developed a character, and that character was not male, it was female. And we wanted to, you know, I just wanted to imagine that a female renting potentially by herself was able to carry this product up a set of stairs unbox it and put it together all by themselves in that short period of time. That was the kind of goal. So we didn't want to make sure that we wanted to make sure that things weren't super heavy and overcomplicated. And don't get me wrong, they're sort of in early stages of assembly. We had to make our tweaks because we learned that even with something that is super, super simple, it can still be very complicated to put together if the instructions aren't right. Mm. And we had sort of parts that were very much the same, look the same, you know, you could still incorrectly put it together, but because they were so similar, we noticed, you know, sort of certain challenges with those first lots of assembly testing where people would go to put it together and not know where to begin because they're like, I can't tell the difference to the parts, and then try to grab one bit, put it into the next, and it would not be right. But you'd spent so much time around the product that you couldn't understand how they could get it wrong. But
And when you design things, sometimes you lose that first, like the ability to look at this product like a first timer. And it's really humbling to see when you put something out that how they actually respond to that and how they actually think about piecing something like a bed together. Because I imagine you've seen some really fascinating people trying to piece these things together in those early days.
Definitely. And I had two really sort of amazing guys that I still work with to today, but that were able to help me through that process of assembly and refining the product to the point that it was able to become something that we could put into the market. And, you know, sort of between Dimitri and Vikram, you know, those two guys were huge in those early stages of helping me get things across the line, especially with Vikram, who worked a lot on insights with me. So he is the head of insight. So he would sort of, you know, he would test the market, ask the right questions, understand, you know, the challenges and the pain points in a slightly different way to me, because he wasn't quite as around the product as me, if that makes sense, or not as sort of absorbed in the
distance.
Distanced enough to be able to see the reality. And there was sort of, you know, there was tough conversations at times, but, you know, but he was sort of able to help me see and understand a better assembly experience. And, you know, and also with what Vic did there, and something that Koala does really well, is that sort of customer survey and customer experience side of things. So looking at going out, we spent a lot of time in people's homes prior and during the design phase to really understand how people live in their homes, how people sleep, what they like, what they dislike. So that was a huge part of the design and development. You know, I didn't really look at this as something that I personally, yes, I was inspired by what I made and I really wanted to put that aesthetic out there, but it was a huge part of that design was driven by customer feedback. So it's almost been designed more by the customer than it has been designed by me in a way.
Yeah. It sounds like you're not just building one piece of furniture in isolation. You're trying to think about how this one piece of furniture may fit cohesively with their other furniture and the way that they live in their own space, and then potentially, I imagine, what future needs they may have and where you may be able to solve other problems that they have for their spaces.
Every single feature that was put into that product was tested or asked in the market, and we got feedback on that. And some of it was, you know, and that drove, I suppose, or gave us a good understanding of the key pain points that we needed to address and what our USPs were going to be for the product.
USP, just for anyone that's not heard that term, that's a unique sales proposition, right?
Correct, yeah. So that unique element was something that is really hard to get into a product sometimes, and we wanted to try our best to do that. You know, where the company was coming from, you know, there was a couple of really solid ones in terms of 4-hour delivery. No one was doing that in the market. Zero tools, zero fixings. There wasn't many people in the market that were doing that. So there was two pretty easy ones to get off the mark if we were able to achieve it. But then, you know, being able to sort of put that, I think the only other one that I can really look at that was in the product that was received really well was our idea to put the pillow storage behind the bed head. And I just have so many memories of beds in the past where you go through this ritual of, before you get to bed, of throwing all of your pillows on the ground. And, you know, my partner, she likes her accessory pillows. So we had a few extra ones on the bed, and there was always this ritual of throwing them on the ground. And I just never really understood why that had to happen and really disliked that. So the idea to just, why can't we just do that behind the bedhead, sort of came up as a question. And that was one of the very first things we put in, and it stayed the whole way through because people responded really well to it. And I still do today put my accessory pillows, if that's what you call them, behind the bed. Yeah.
But I think it does really highlight how you understand people and their intent and how they use that particular design. In this case, the bed base, like, you know, that experience that you have with your wife, those accessory pillows, like, you've designed a solution to solve essentially what is a problem. Because you get up in the mornings, accessory pillows are all over the floor. You might trip, fall, hit your head, who knows what, because they're a trip hazard there, right?
Yeah, something so soft can be really dangerous, right?
Yeah. What was the biggest challenge that you found through designing the bed base?
Probably selecting the right material. Mm. It needed to tick so many boxes, and it needed to be at a quality and at a level that allowed us to manufacture it and hold stock. You know, one of the most important things with Koala is being able to give a customer something in quite a short turnaround. You know, there's a lot of companies that you buy a piece of furniture from, there usually is a lead time, and you have to, unless it's very rarely held in stock, and you have to wait six, you know, two, three, up to 16 weeks for a piece of furniture. So we need this product to be in stock all the time. And if it sells successfully, we need to be able to hold a lot of stock. And working with a raw material, you need to be able to manage that process and find a way to make sure you find the right product, the right quality of material that allows you to hold that level of stock and also be able to produce the details that you need to, because this was a toolless connection. So we needed to make sure that the quality of the material, the quality of the substrate was right. So that became almost a 1.5 year investigation, let's call it that, sort of, in terms of trying to source the right materials. And it took us all over the world.
Yeah.
So we needed to make sure that we were not only ticking sustainability boxes, but we were also ticking the boxes that allowed us to sort of to access enough of the material.
Mm. And you mentioned sustainability. How does sustainability actually factor into the design decisions that you make at Koala?
That's huge. Yeah, it's huge. We need to make sure it ticks all of the necessary boxes in terms of where the products come from, the way that the forest is being managed, the glues that they're using that go into the product, the veneers that are being chosen, and everything. We look into all of those factors, and that's sort of why we ended up going to Europe to look for material, because we didn't want to tap into the Australian timber, because it wasn't the right fit for us. There's a lot that gets consumed in the construction industry in Australia, and we needed to meet a particular level of quality. And we found an incredible material that we're using for all of our new products that comes out of Europe. So it was a great experience to be able to go over and see those forests and how they're managed and how the factories work. And we saw factories that were 100% run by the waste of the product, so the wood chips that came off the shavings that made the plywood, that all went back into a furnace and 100% fueled the factory. Like, we saw some really cool things and learned a hell of a lot over there. And to know with these future products that are coming out that it is coming from that area and it is super sustainable, and that we're not creating a problem in the environment is a really important factor.
Yeah, I think it's something most modern consumers are going to be very conscious of, particularly right now in Australia. There's massive bushfires, and this is a very hot topic literally for us right now.
Yeah, it is, mate. Yeah, and that's sort of knowing, you know, that we want to continue on into the future using timber-based products. It's something that's really important to us. But, you know, it's not, for me as a designer, it's not about designing things and pushing for, you know, excess consumption. You know, we want to create pieces of furniture, and I want to create pieces of furniture that people keep for a lifetime. Mm. You know, I don't want it to be, which you see so often, you know, I don't want it to be that piece of furniture that's on the side of the road after the second move or the first move. You know, and that was really one of the biggest pieces of feedback we got, especially with the bed, was, you know, with competitor-based products, when they get pulled apart, they usually get damaged on that disassembly. And that disassembly process generally relates to someone not wanting to take that product to the next move, and they would leave it on the side of the road. And I just didn't want this product to be like that. You know, we wanted to design something that was, in a way, iconic, if we could, that meant that people would want to hand it down or pass it on or keep it. So.
Mm. Yeah, I know for me, like when I first saw the bed base, it looked beautiful, but in having mine for, it must be like 2 years now, it feels like something I definitely want to keep for a lifetime.
It's
sheer ability to like pick it apart, move it, not get damaged. It's a remarkable piece of design.
Thank you, mate. Appreciate that.
I wanted to ask you about the detail of the bed base that you're most proud of as well. What might that be?
As much as I want to say pillow storage, I've never been much of a pillow accessory kind of guy. So it's that was probably one that was more for my partner than for me.
Mm.
I think the thing that I'm most proud of is just creating something that other people are proud to own and have come and given me that feedback. There's so many little details that I've put into it where I wanted to, you know, have the feeling of it floating. So I angle the legs in a particular way so you just see a shadow line in most areas of a bedroom when you're walking around it. You know, I wanted to see just enough timber or just enough of that veneer as you look around the edges, you know, not having the sharp corners. So, you know, you remove the potential of someone kicking something during, like kicking it when they're walking to the bathroom or getting out of bed in the morning, you know, all of those little features were things that I'm very proud of. But, there's not a specific detail that's on it that I'm proud of, but it was just being able to, as a designer, I'm proud of that's the first thing that I've ever made that had zero tools, zero fixings.
Yeah.
You know, I'll take that with me for the rest of my life to say that was my first project that had that brief requirement.
Tell you what, for me, like what I love about the bed base too is, and you've mentioned sharp corners a couple of times, and now that I think of it, every bed that I've ever owned has a corner that I've kicked my shin and I must have divots carved out of my shins from just waking up in the middle of the night, still being really sleepy and then just hitting the edge of the bed and then waking up whoever I'm sleeping with and then causing a whole big thing. And since getting this, the Koala bed base, I just have not had that experience since.
The two pain points for me was, I had this really sharp corner on the end that I would always hit with my shins or kick when I was getting out of bed. And the other one was the mattress sat quite deep into the bed. So I would constantly scrape the tops of my hand nails trying to tuck my sheets in and change the bed every time. So, you know, it was that sort of was one of the reasons why a platform bed was going to be the first thing that I designed, because there was no way I was going to be designing something that had this big 200-300 mil kind of drop in design to it, because there's just, I had a lot of negative thoughts around that.
Mm. So you're probably like taking in your own problems when you were designing as well.
A little bit of that, solutions. There was definitely, I know I said it was definitely a lot of customer feedback and, you know, user feedback. There was a couple of things that I had to try and get in for myself. which turned out to be other people's issues as well. But yeah, that was just, the amount of times that I remember, that past bed that I had trying to change that bloody mattress and scratching my hands putting it in and out, it just
It seems so obvious in hindsight to design solutions for those things, but it seems like a lot of people don't actually think about those common problems that show up as well,
potentially.
And if you were to design or redesign the bed base from scratch again, is there anything that you would do differently, or would you approach it in a different way?
Oh, mate, always improvements. The second you make your first prototype, you make improvements or want to change it. There's lots of things that you look at and would like to improve. But you know, we do that via feedback in the company, I suppose. So we get this out into market and we have an amazing review process that, you know, we get almost every product that goes out, you know, our customer will review that and give us feedback. We've been really lucky with the bed that the majority of it has been 5-star reviews. So everyone's just super stoked with their experience with it. But it's those small percentage of issues that come through that you look at and go, this is an improvement we can make. So we're actually, you know, we're in the process of looking at what a 2.0 would look like for that. I can't sort of say too much about that at this point, but we're always looking at what improvements we can make, not only in the the assembly or the quality of the product or the experience, but also in, you know, improving manufacturing efficiency, always trying to make things more sustainable or use less material and things like that. So, yeah. Mm.
I absolutely love that as well. Like you've started with one product and you're looking to iterate and just improve it. Like you've got a great product already, but what you've just said is like, perhaps it could be better. Let's explore it. And not a lot of companies or people just think about their products or the things that they make through that lens. Like they're not looking to continually improve it. And I think it's such a testament to the quality of the company and the design that goes on at Koala that you're actually doing that.
Yeah, it's a huge part of our process is to always retro something, look at something in retrospect and just go, you know, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? What can we do next time to improve it and put that into our development pipeline and work on it again? So, yeah, and, you know, you even with future products or things that might not necessarily be bed related, you know, we're able to put that learning into that almost straight away. So it sort of has a carry-on effect into other product areas. So, and, you know, because we're trying to do something that's, you know, a little bit different to traditional furniture companies, you know, it does have its challenges, but we're learning and evolving pretty quickly,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. And what are the things that you've learned from the bed base that you've applied to some of the new products that Koala are launching, like the TV unit?
Oh, you know, we learned some assembly and connection detail challenges, I suppose. You know, we definitely needed to improve certain, well, not improve, but we needed to see how those connection details could potentially adapt into a new product. We needed to continue to improve the material because we needed to make sure that we could find a way to potentially use less material or use a better quality material as we moved into other products. You know, and we also needed to, with something like the TV unit, we needed to look at how we tackle a cabinet, which was different to a bed. So that was another challenge. So we, you know, we sort of had four or five different designs and iterations that we'd looked at in that process, but there was a big drive to want to try and aesthetically produce something that was similar because we did like the features and the style and the feel that the bed base had because there's something quite minimal about it. And I've always been with a lot of things that I've designed in the past and a lot of things that I've designed at Koala, I'm trying to be more about creating a canvas more so than a statement piece. So it's something that addresses all those issues, but it's something that really, in a way, can fall into the background a little bit and let personal possessions and things that you put onto it create the life in that product.
Yeah.
So that's sort of, I don't know, again, I don't know if that answered the question entirely, but that was sort of the drive for, you know, for future products that we're looking at and especially for the TV unit. Because it does go together in a very similar way to the bed, but we just had to tackle the cabinetry side of it a little bit.
And what were the unique challenges of designing the TV unit that showed up when you started to explore these different potential ways that it could look?
Besides the thing actually going together and tackling the cabinetry, it was cable management. You know, if I look at accessory pillows and kicking shins and assembly as being huge pain points for the bed, you know, cables for a TV unit was a really big one.
100%.
You know, I had this TV unit at home at the time, which just had this dusty pile of crap sitting behind it that, you know, just was really, really said to me that there's got to be a better way that we can do it. So that was one of the biggest challenges initially is how do we take the average person's, you know, number of devices. You know, we're not sort of saying we're going to try and target someone that's got, you know, 50 different electronic devices, but, you know, the average number of devices, how can we take that and house them and house the cables and everything in a neat and organized way. That was a huge challenge, and we did a lot of different testing to get that one across. And then also how did we do something that was simple in terms of accessing all of the areas of the unit, you know, in terms of being zero tools, zero fixings, using things like hardware for runners and drawers and doors and things like that was definitely going to be a big challenge. So I really just went back to basics with that one and thought, what if we just do a really simple sliding door? And again, there was always that fear of this is going to be too simple. This is not going to be enough of a technically evolved product to get people to want to buy it. But the first couple of tests that we did with it, you know, it worked really well, and the simplicity and how it goes together and how the door slides and sort of shows the section that you need to access and closes it back over, you know, it does the job well and truly. So yeah, we were pretty stoked with that.
It allows people to showcase their own possessions, right? Like, it's part of that canvas philosophy that you mentioned about.
Definitely.
It's kind of receding into the background somewhat.
Yeah, we did a huge amount of, in terms of our design process, we call it like our parameters that we work on, and we look at the different sizes of electronics and devices that go into the unit, the different ways that people would, you know, sort of need to access things, and that idea of, you know, having to bend all the way over the back to change a cord and things like that. We realized that most cabinets are too big, so we wanted to give front and rear access to being able to unplug cords. So we sort of created a little sliding cavity that comes up in the middle and shows where the power board is, and you can put it back down and keep doing what you're doing. So you're sort of doing all of that work was sort of hugely important to what we hope is create a successful product. You know, it's very early on in its launch of into the market. It sort of only came out sort of late last year. So it's, you know, we're sort of hoping that a lot of those features are received well.
Mm, fantastic. And is there a detail that you're proud of on the TV unit?
Yeah, I really like the cable management. I know that sounds a bit nerdy, but it's sort of, I like the fact that we're able to create this sort of like false panel. So once it's closed, you don't even really know it's there, but it's there. But when you're sitting there and you're looking at your TV unit, watching TV, you know, most of the stuff is hidden. You can still see your devices, right? Because you might need to, you know, use your PlayStation or your Apple TV or whatever it is that you've got. But I just like the fact that the majority of that mess is hidden. And then even if you go to the back of the unit to vacuum behind it or whatever, it's still inside the unit. So you just, yeah, that's the cable part of it is probably the thing I'm most proud of. I really like the style of it too. I remember when we got one of our first prototypes, I was so excited to get it home and get rid of my other TV unit so I could get this thing in and see how it looked and felt, because I just, I was really proud of the aesthetic of it. I think it was quite, yeah.
Actually, I purchased a TV unit about a year ago, and my girlfriend always tells me about how, like, I typically do pretty well about purchasing furniture, in particular around assembly and making sure that it's easy to assemble. But this one thing looked like it was going to be easy, and it must have had 150 different screws. And I sat there for about 8 hours assembling this thing. I'm like, oh, I just have to throw this thing out. Like, I have to get rid of this. I hate this thing in my life right now. It's such a pain. So yeah. I think that making it easy for people to assemble and hiding those details is really ultra important.
There was a similar fear with this one, right? In terms of could we do the same thing as the bed? Could we make this thing go together in a couple of minutes? It didn't feel possible at the time, because every product that we tested would take, you know, 20, 30, 40 minutes plus to put together.
What would you say might be one of the most important qualities for a person to have as a furniture designer, if they were to take on the ideas that you push forward with Koala? Is there something that's really ultra important that you would say they would need to have?
I suppose one of the things that I've learned recently that's come to mind is, you know, do you want to design for yourself or for other people? You need to understand that first and foremost, because if you wanted to design for yourself, you know, you can still do that and get a lot of enjoyment from it. But, you know, there's a slightly different way that you would probably approach that. Whereas designing for other people, you know, if that's what you want to do, which is something that I quite enjoy doing, you know, you need to listen to other people.
Yeah.
That's probably the most important thing. So, you know, understand that there is a process before starting that idea in some way, because you've got to find the problem. So, you know, starting out as a furniture designer, you know, going back to what I was talking about getting your hands dirty, learn how things go together. Yeah. Go and do a little woodworking course. There's some amazing places around Australia that you can go and learn those hands-on elements if you haven't, because using your hands to create those things will make you a better designer, especially a better furniture designer. So that's sort of, yeah, getting your hands dirty probably be the most important thing. But yeah, in terms of working as a designer in Australia commercially, you know, definitely understanding that you need to design for other people and not yourself is probably important. At least that's something that's important to me.
Yeah, because you're not going to be the only person buying it, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and you're learning what other people like and dislike too, in different market segments, different areas. You know, they're really important, because you know that, and being able to, if you are working for a company and you're sort of fairly new to that company, or that company is new to the market, really trying to understand who it is that you want to design for, so you can kind of create that link. And you know, if you know who you're designing for, because I know if I was designing these products for my parents, it's probably entirely the wrong market and they're not going to want that. But you know, we understand our market and who we want to design for pretty well, I think, and that's probably one of the most important things you need to do before kicking things off.
Yeah, have a key person in mind that these products that you're making is going to be designed for. Sounds like the thing that you really want people to focus on. Is there any advice that you would give to someone perhaps studying industrial design or furniture design, or thinking about making a career switch into this field?
Yeah. I mean, if they're just about to start or they're currently through it, keep going, because it's a bloody good job. It's I really, really enjoy being a designer. There's sort of one of the guys that I work with at the moment, Francesco, we sort of quite often have these moments where we say we've got the best job in the world. You know, it's just for me personally, I love doing it. So if I can inspire someone who wants to study it or is going to study it by letting them know how I feel about that, there's not many better feelings for me than creating something. So yeah, that's and find some good mentors. You know, if where you're studying it doesn't give you access to that, you know, get off your chair and go and knock on some doors or pick up the phone or send an email. But be, you know, I sort of grew up working with some pretty old school people. So if you want to work with manufacturers and you want to work with furniture in particular, don't send them an email. Go and knock on their door, go and show them your face and speak to them face to face. You know, that's sort of, they'll respond much better to you in that way. Because they, you know, they're real people. And, you know, sometimes I think we get caught behind our computers and our phones a little bit too much. So, yeah.
Yeah, like a little bit isolated in a lot of ways, like just focusing on your own little vacuum perhaps.
Yes. Yeah. But that mentor side of things, like finding someone that you can chat to about ideas and problems that you're facing and things like that, that have had experience in that area, or even if it's not necessarily direct in-line experience with what you're working on, you know, they can share things with you that just help you evolve as a person. And from a design perspective, it's so important to do that. You know, I've been pretty lucky to work with some pretty cool people and, you know, learn a lot along the way, but also have the understanding. And if you get a good mentor, you know, they'll never let you stagnate on something or stagnate on an aesthetic or an idea for too long. They'll continue to push the direction that you're going.
Yeah, that is the value of a mentor, right? To keep challenging you to be better than you were yesterday with the things that you're designing and making.
Yeah.
And where can people find you if they're curious? Are you online anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, LinkedIn's pretty easy these days if you need to reach out. Otherwise, jump on Instagram and you can send me a message on there. That's probably, I don't use Facebook that much these days, so probably Insta or LinkedIn would be the easiest. Yeah.
And what's your handle on Instagram?
Handle? Adam underscore Harrigan, I'm pretty sure. You're testing my memory now. Yeah. I'm not huge on social media, but I do try to post things here and there. I try not to post too much about my daughter, but I'm pretty obsessed with her at the moment. So
Yeah. Fantastic. Any parting thoughts before we wrap up?
Oh, get your hands dirty.
Yeah, that seems to be the common story here.
Go and make the body thing. Yeah, I suppose that would probably be my parting one. But get your hands dirty.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for your time. This has been a really fantastic conversation. I've really loved to get into the details and how you think and how you approach problem solving and the work that you're actually doing with Koala. I'm super inspired by the work that you're doing and the way that you're actually thinking about people's needs. And I'm just excited for what you guys build next.
So am I, mate. Yeah, it's very excited. There's a lot still to come from Koala. So, yeah.
I'm excited to see where you guys go.
Thanks, Mike.
Hey there, it's Mike again. I wanted to say thank you for your time, attention, and listening this far. So what did you think? If you like this episode and want to hear more, you can subscribe to The Goods on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, Spotify, or get The Goods on your favorite podcast network or listening apps. This podcast only exists with the support of people like you. If you got valuable advice, a great insight, or see potential in the show, I'd really appreciate it if you'd consider leaving a rating and review. Thank you, and practice good design.